Okay, so here's the, this is the Creation Roadshow.
Oh.
Are we on this bus? Let me tell you where we, where we've gone. I want to pick up the pieces of the first two lectures. How many people are nuevo, or new? Okay, so I'm just going to do, you know, the Cliff's Notes of Monday and Tuesday. But before we begin, I want to thank the Days of Creation from yesterday. We had 7 days of creation. People read beautifully. Thank you so much. And so I want to pick up the pieces of the first 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, just so we're all on the same, we're all in the same place. So this will be the Cliff's Notes of those 2 days. And I want to pick up the pieces in a way. Because as I tried to underscore yesterday, out of these pieces, the new creation always comes out of the pieces of something else. And it's out of the pieces of the old creation that the new creation comes. Out of these pieces, a new creation. I'm doing this like a rock song, and that's the repeat. And so out of the pieces of what I've been doing over those last 2 days comes what we're going to do today. So, here's the thing. We'll begin with the Carmelite nun. She seems to be a frequent visitor of these things. This is an 80-year-old nun who's been reading the same text over and over and over again in scripture. And my friend asked her, well, how do you keep reading the same old texts over and over and over again and find something new in them? And she said, I read the texts until they surprise me. I read the texts over and over and over again until they surprise me. And I think that's really, really important because I think we are creatures who want a world where there are no surprises. We want no surprises, and we get a God who is full of surprises. We call it grace. Sometimes those surprises are good and sometimes not so good. But we get a God who's full of surprises. We want a God who will give us some answers. I always get students, and I told the story of one who says, what should I do? And we're people who want answers, and we get a God who is full of questions. And we'll see more and more of those questions today in the book of Job, in the divine speeches at the end of Job. And that's really, it's important to ask questions. And sometimes asking the right question is even more important than getting the answer to the wrong one. Asking the right question is even more important than getting the answer to the wrong one. So here, hey, it's cute. Okay, so here's what I was surprised by in reading the texts of Genesis, those familiar texts in the first chapters of creation. First thing I was surprised by is God calls the creation into being. God creates, not by command, but by invitation, by naming, and by blessing. By invitation, God doesn't say, dry land, seas, air, come, be. God says, let there be light. And there was light. And the Hebrew word is a word of invitation. So God creates not by command, but by invitation. And then God names these various pieces of creation. And Catherine asked about naming, and asked if I'd say a little bit more about naming. So that's a piece I wanted to come back to. What happens when we give something a name?
We have a handle on it.
It becomes more real.
Yeah.
More
ownership.
We have a relationship. We have ownership. We have. We can't control it, maybe, but we do. We have a handle on it. We say that it is this and not that. We say that it's a relationship. Naming confers a relationship. When I was called a Storz, that conferred a certain kind of identity and a certain kind of belonging. Yeah. To a certain place and a certain people, right? Naming gives us a sense of belonging. What else does naming do?
Doesn't bring you into being.
It animates stuff. You know, naming animates stuff. And I think you know, I watched this on the streets of Berkeley. One of my students was the director of the food project, emergency food project and shelter, and she knew every homeless person in Berkeley by name. Mm-hmm. And she would walk through the streets and say, "Hey, Shafiq, how you doing?" You know, and it was better than giving them a buck. Mm-hmm. You know, because, and I watched these people come to life, and she named them Sherry and Shafiq, and they were more to her than the dot lady or the naked man, and these, or the poet, and these were the regular street people in Berkeley. But she had a name for them, and that naming kind of animated them. So. Yeah.
Don't farmers often tell their kids not to name any of the animals? Because then, in, I think in Charlotte's Web,
yes.
the father doesn't want her to name the pig.
Exactly.
Because then,
you're a
cat.
It creates relationship,
uh-huh.
doesn't it? It creates relationship. And, you know, God speaks in the Genesis chapters, and suddenly there's an us. There's God and God's words. And those words then animate, and it's kind of like a snowball rolling down a hill. There's more and more and more stuff. And it all has a name, and I think particularly in this first accounts of Genesis, what that naming does is it gives everything a place. Naming is sort of an assignment. You belong, you creature, you belong to the air. You creature, you fish, you belong to the seas. You sea monsters, I love that sea monsters get a role in this. Sea monsters, you belong to the seas. You, let's see, birds of the air, you belong in this dome of the sky. You know, so there's kind of, naming gives everything a place for everything and everything in its place, especially in these first accounts of creation. So naming is really powerful. What names do we get as Christians?
Child of God.
Child of God. And that gives us an identity. It animates us. It gives us a place to belong and a people to belong to. And in the ancient world, when, you know, when you could die for being a Christian, people used that name very, very, that name protected them. That name animated them. Even in the Colosseum. So it's very powerful, that naming. I've always been struck with how we confuse in our rituals of baptism, we sometimes confuse christening with baptism, and there are two different names at play here. Baptism isn't giving a child a family name like Martha Ellen Storrs. I mean, I got that when my parents finally figured out, fought out what I was to be, who I was to be. But the name I get in baptism is not that name, it's child of God. And then with that comes blessing. You are the beloved one. With you, I am well pleased. So it's fascinating. I mean, baptism is almost an anti-christening ceremony. Because it takes me out of my family of blood and places me in a new family of the brothers and sisters of Christ. So I don't know. That's a scary thing. I think baptizing is pretty terrifying, actually. People really knew what was going on. They'd run with their kiddos from the church and go, wait a minute, we're not ready for this yet. But anyway, that naming piece is really crucial. And then God calls and blesses. And the refrain of creation, the rock song of creation is, and God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was very good. Okay? So God creates by invitation, naming, blessing. And then God leads the creation by questions. And those questions you can serve for a lifetime. So if you get tired of these questions, that's good. I want everybody to be able to recite these questions when they leave the village. It will be your bus ticket. So anyway, those questions of creation that God asks, and God knows the answer to these questions, the important thing is for us to listen. Where are you? Adam, where are you? But it's a great question to ask on a personal, existential, political, Holden Village kind of level. Adam, where are you? Who told you that? Who told you that you were naked? What are the scripts that you live out? What have you done And this is the question God poses to Eve. What have you done? And he's asking for an accounting, or she is asking for an accounting of what happened from Eve's point of view. And we get into this huge cycle of blaming because Eve blames the serpent, and Adam blames Eve. This is Adam blaming Eve. And then Adam even blames God. This woman that you gave me, that you made for me. And then the other question, why are you angry? And anger came up yesterday in a couple of settings. So let me just say a couple of things about anger. My hunch is that beneath anger is always fear. And I thought of a really pedestrian analogy. I was in a faculty meeting. Everybody's angry. There's a lot of anger. Politics are so nasty because the stakes are so small, right? But it's so, congregational life, yes. So the politics are so nasty because the stakes are so small, but people are really pissed off in the room. It's divided. And finally, one of my wiser colleagues just said, you know what, you guys, what I am really afraid of. And he began to spin out his fears. And lo and behold, underneath the division, we all had the same fear. And that we could move from that fear. But until we had named it, and addressed it, and just had it in the room with us, we were gonna tear each other's skin off. So I find that as a really interesting and very, very, very ordinary example of how fear drives us. Look at the war on terror. A sort of response of rage, maybe an over-response. It scared the hell out of me because I thought, this enemy is so abstract and so inchoate, it could be anybody. But underneath that anger was a fear that we were no longer top dog, that we were not secure, that we were not invulnerable. And that fear really drove us. And, you know, that's when I began to see a number of scholars talking about the politics of fear, which is still very much at play, I think, in our political life. Third example, what do you think Jesus says more than anything else? Well, the second thing he repeats over and over and over again in the Gospels. He had his finger on the pulse of what really drives us. So, yeah. Okay, so we don't need to see anything more about that. This is the picture of the final question, where is your brother? And this is a slate illustration of Cain. You see Abel dead up here. You see Adam and Eve weeping. That may or may not have been the case. Larry, I think this was, I don't know whether Blake has misinterpreted this or I have, but I think I said yes, I said when I introduced this that Cain was horrified at what he had done. And I don't know that from this etching. He's just horrified. And we see a shovel here. He was a tiller of the earth. What I'd love to see is the earth crying out, but the earth is empty. You know, this is a grave that has been dug for the brother of, well, or for Abel. So this is a very powerful illustration. And I don't know whether Blake has it wrong, but I certainly didn't. And Larry's point yesterday was, fratricide, the killing of a brother, is also the killing of the earth. Because the earth cries out when Abel has been killed. It has received blood into the earth. Blood has been poured into the earth, and that's kind of an unnatural substance and certainly an unwelcome one. I mean, this is a great anti-war. When blood goes into the earth cries out. And if you've ever been to the sites of great battles, Gettysburg, Culloden, the beaches at Normandy, you know that the earth is still crying out. When blood goes into the earth cries out. So I don't know what to say. But read Larry's book. It's a very powerful image. The earth cries out at the death of Abel. Okay. So the next thing I wanted to, that was that. And then talked about yesterday, or a day two, an evening, a morning, a second day. The pattern that surprises me in these first stories of creation is this pattern of breaking and remaking. It's out of the pieces that a new creation is born. For day to happen, day has to be split off from night. For anything to be created, that smooth stone of matter has to be shattered. This is the creation of Adam, and Adam is really wrested away from the earth. Adam is really, you can see a serpent or a snaky creature trying to hold on to Adam, to hold Adam into where Adam came from, the soil, as Larry was talking yesterday. And it's a really powerful, powerful image. So creation always happens out of the pieces of something else. And I wanted to look at just two things that I didn't get a chance to talk about yesterday. I wonder if this should really surprise us. Because the central practices, and we are also a broken band of disciples. We'll talk about that tomorrow when I look at Matthew. Because that band that Jesus puts together at the beginning of his public ministry, he doesn't recruit the A students. He doesn't recruit the physically fit. He doesn't recruit the ace runners or sharpshooters. He recruits the poor in spirit. He recruits the meek. He recruits those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. He pulls together people who have been broken. And it's out of these pieces that he creates his disciples. So out of these pieces, a new creation comes. And I think we see this in the central practices of our tradition. We take a loaf of bread for the breaking of the bread. We take a loaf of bread and we break it. And it's actually kind of a nice, perfect loaf. And we break it into pieces. And then we break it into even more pieces. And then we take those pieces and they get devoured by people who eat them. So we replicate a central act of breakage in one of our sacraments. We actually do it in the other sacrament as well. In baptism, we take a child, in a way, out of its family of origin, out of its family of blood, and put it in the midst of a new family, and a family of brothers and sisters in Christ. And it is really a separation, a breakage, if you will. And in the ancient church, when families of blood were often pagan or didn't worship Christ, were not Christian, baptism really was a separation and a breakage from families of origin. To be a child of God meant you weren't a child of Patricius and Monica. You were a child of a new family, and that family would support you where your own family might, in fact, disown you. So we see in these great martyrologies, and I'm thinking of one of Perpetua and Felicitas from North Africa, where they keep asking Perpetua in the court, in the Roman court, who are you? And she says she denies her father, her family of origin. She denies her husband, her family of choice, the legal family. She even denies her own child, and she keeps saying, I am a Christian. I am a Christian. She claims membership in that family of the children of God. So it's extraordinary. There are times when in the history of the church when baptism really was a very violent separation from all the families which would want to claim you, and incorporation into the new family. So there is breakage there. And I want to ask, should this surprise us? Because we see that pattern of breaking and remaking in Jesus himself, in the body of Jesus himself. That body was broken and crucified, and in a way, out of those pieces of the broken body of Jesus comes the risen Christ. And Thomas, whom we always call Doubting Thomas, Thomas won't believe it until he can touch those pieces of the old creation, right? He wants to touch the wounds of Jesus. And the extraordinary thing is that there's proof available. The risen Christ bears the marks of the crucified Jesus. And there's visible proof available. So out of these pieces comes a new creation. I saw this really vividly portrayed in El Salvador. And Archbishop Romero, in weeks before he died, he said, "I will rise again. I will be resurrected in the Salvadoran people." And at the chapel, in the Jesuit chapel at the University of Central America in San Salvador, where they would usually have around the church the Stations of the Cross, which are pieces of the Passion of Jesus, they have instead etchings of the wounded bodies of the Salvadoran people, raped, tortured, whipped by barbed wire and whips filled with bullet holes. And these are really graphically and vividly put in places, 14 of them around that chapel. And it's a sense that we are that broken body of Christ, and we will rise in the Salvadoran people. I do want to show that. Has anybody seen it? Has anybody been to El Salvador? I'm kind of an Ignatian Lutheran, so it's a site of pilgrimage for me. But in any event, here are some ground rules for living in this new creation. And I wanted to conclude with these yesterday. First ground rule. Navigating this new creation, which is made of the broken pieces of the old creation, takes time. You have to go slowly. Sometimes it takes more than 7 days. You never know whether you're in day one or day seven. Maybe you're in day five. But you can trust that there is evening and there is morning and there is a second day. The second point I wanted to make, that just as God blesses each of these shards of the old creation and makes of them a new creation, God blesses broken pieces today. So I don't know what to say except expect blessings. The third point that needs to be made here, and I mentioned this a little bit yesterday, is that the new creation is just that, it is something new. Ronald Rollheiser makes this point in his book, The Holy Longing. But he says, resurrection is not resuscitation. You never get the old creation back again. When I was widowed about 8 years ago, and I kept telling my friends, you know, if you see my old life walking around, would you please tell it where I live? I think it's forgotten. But I knew that that old life was not coming back again. And I didn't know what day of creation I was in the new life. And I just had to practice resurrection. And that's a Wendell Berry line. Wendell Berry gets this too, practice resurrection. And then the fourth point, probably self-evident by now, embrace breakage. It's the stuff of a new creation. And save your stuff. I don't know. It's the stuff of a new creation. So I wanted to end that piece with this picture. You all know what this is, right? Hands. It's the creation of Adam from the Sistine Chapel, right? And what I love about this is the two fingers, God's and Adam's, are barely touching. There's still a little space in between them. But that space is filled with a cry. So there's breakage, yes? It's pretty great. Yes. Okay, I have a picture for you, June. It's at the end. Yes. Okay, so any questions about that? Okay, so this is what... Alright, so here's what I want to do now with Joe. I want to look at an alternative story of creation. And let's do that. Is everybody ready? So we're now going to be in the book of Job. But this is still another creation story. Job is right before the Psalms. And I think the 24-hour question is, why is that such an interesting placement? But here's how I want to get into the book of Job. I want to get into it as a child. Because as a child, I thought there was just one creation story, right? I think that maybe a lot of us did. And it worked like a fairy tale. In the beginning, God. Must be the Bible's way of saying, once upon a time. God saw that it was good. Must be the Bible's way of saying, and they lived happily ever after. And in between, there was a place for everything, and everything was in its place. There was a dome under the heavens, and certain things belonged there, and certain times governed their belonging. The sun belonged to that dome of the sky during the day, and the moon and stars belonged to that dome of the sky during the night. And day or night, in the dome of the heavens belonged every winged bird of every kind. And there was dry land, and all the plants and animals belonged on dry land, except some of the animals belonged in the seas. And the seas were for fish and sea monsters, and there was a place for everything, and everything was in its place. This must be right, because this is what our mother told us about our toys. Now, how shocked I was years later to discover that there are actually two creation stories, and they're kind of right on top of each other. And they have a rather different ordering of things. The second begins with the creation of humans, and then the creation of man and woman bookend everything else, all of which happens in a garden. And nothing in either of these stories ends happily ever after, because there is a snake who hasn't been made to crawl on his belly yet, but stands upright as if the snake were a human, and makes a promise, seduces the couple with promise of the knowledge of good and evil, and things go sort of downhill after that. And I'm glad I didn't run into that story of creation until after I had experiences of both seduction and of endings that don't end happily ever after. Still, I like the image of a snake that hasn't yet had to crawl on its belly. And medieval artists often had the snake standing upright and walking with a cane, with an ivory handle. So this is very fun. Then, decades later, I discover that there's a third story of creation. And that's the story of creation that is embedded in the book of Job. And I never recognized this as a story of creation, but there is Satan. And Satan is upright again, walking and talking. And I had never recognized this as a story of creation because it doesn't begin like a fairy tale, once upon a time. It doesn't even begin like a biblical fairy tale, in the beginning. This story of creation really begins. Do you remember how the book of Job begins? God and Satan in this story has a definite article in front of its name. It's not just Satan, it's the Satan, right? Oh, that's pretty sinister. So they have a conversation, and God says, remember my servant, or what about my servant Job? You can do everything with Job except take his life. And then the story begins with fire falling from heaven and consuming everything it descends upon, and with enemy tribes pouring over the horizon with bad intent, and they make off with Job's servants and with Job's children, and Job himself is beset with boils and loathsome sores and shunning neighbors and betraying friends. So this is a story of creation that does not begin well at all, right? And we know that anybody in the ancient world who had a skin disease, lepers, had to go outside the gates of the city. So here's this very wealthy guy with a lot of land and a lot of servants and a lot of kids and a lot of cattle and a lot of sheep and camels. And he's really at the center of urban life, and everybody comes to Job for counsel. Everybody comes to Job for advice, and suddenly Job is on the outside. He doesn't have everything that made him look great, and he's got to go outside the city because he's got skin trouble. So I can see why the book of Job doesn't surface in Sunday school education. And it's probably a good thing, because I think nobody would ever put away their toys. But Job represents the other side of creation. And as I said, enemy tribes strip Job of his children, and fire falls from heaven and consumes his servants and livestock. And even Job's friends betray him, and they try to convince Job he's committed some secret sin. I want to stay with Job's friends for a moment. Because it seems to me, as you know, Janine Olson is talking a lot about grief, Job's friends give us both a good way to be with somebody in grief and a bad way to be with somebody in grief. And this kind of surprised me. These are William Blake's illustrations of the book of Job. And here is when Job's friends are kind of doing the right thing. When Job is stricken, they come to him. They put ashes on their head. They kneel with him, and they just sit with him in silence for 7 days and seven nights without a word. They just come and hang out with him without saying anything. They try to share his suffering to the degree that they possibly can. And they don't open their mouths. So that seems to me a good way of being with somebody in suffering. They kind of fall apart when they spoke and the three friends start trying to figure out what's going on and trying to explain, and they interrogate Job and they ask questions, you know, what have you done? Surely you must have a secret sin. Surely something must have gone wrong that you're not telling us. And they point the finger again at Job. And this is a great contrast. This is not such a great way to be with somebody in grief. It's to try to explain it or try to help them sort it out on your terms. So good grief, bad grief. But it's kind of fascinating. And they all open their mouths trying to explain things, trying to see if Job has anything going on. And the interesting thing is that in all of this, and I think this is really an important point, in all of this, Job never says, why me? And me is a word that's an accusative case. Job never says, why me? He never surrenders his agency in all of this, even though it's shrunk to a smaller and smaller point. Let me give an illustration of this. I have a friend who's about 80 years old, and she's in Southern California. And she had a disastrous stroke. And for a long time, she was talking, a stroke paralyzed me. A stroke paralyzed my left side. A stroke took my mobility away. And I was concerned because this stroke was doing a lot of things to her. I knew she was on the road to recovery when she started talking like, I got a cane. It's purple. My cane has glitter on it. I use my cane every day. People like she was taking the A, I, back. She was reclaiming some agency. Even though she didn't have full mobility, she still limped a little bit on the outside. She's using this purple glitter cane. I love my cane, she said, and I thought, man, she is on the way. Job, and this is kind of striking when you think about it, Job never surrenders his agency. I'll read a couple of passages. You don't have to look at what. The first one is from Job, the second chapter, he says, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord took away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job never assumes the role of victim. He is always present to his suffering as an I. I wish I had never been born. I cry out to you. I stand, even at the end of the book of Job, after all the speeches from the whirlwind, and Job would seem to have been mown down by the creation machine. Even then, Job responds as the subject of his own feelings, not as the object of the Satan's wrath. And that is really important. His field of agency has shrunk, has diminished, but he never surrenders the I. And I gotta say, when I was caring for my husband who died of brain cancer, and I talked a little bit about this yesterday. I mean, what we could do got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and yet every day I would plan a surprise for us. And the surprises got tinier. But a new recipe, a new walk, a new TV show. We watched The Sopranos because it was so consoling to have people who were messing up their lives out of their own volition, you know? They're voluntarily messing things up. We were involuntarily in the midst of this. But that was really important, never to surrender the eye. And at the end of the whole thing, and Job appears to be mown over by the creation machine, Job says to God, and this is some of the best poetry in Scripture, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Boy, that's stunning. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. That's about all Job can do, is look. But he still acknowledges that I see God. It's extraordinary. In using that word I, and in refusing to give it up and become merely a me, I think Job asserts his ability to respond to God. And I suddenly realized, and this was my surprise in studying the book of Job, I suddenly realized, gosh, you know, isn't this what we're told to do when Jesus keeps telling people over and over again, ask for what you need. Ask for what you need. And I'm sort of thinking, man, don't you already know? You know what I need. You know what I need better than I do. So let's just have it. I want some answers. I want some direction. I want no surprises. But it's very interesting. In prayer, we have to use the word I. I want, I love, I wish, I desire. I wish you would tell me what to do. Well, that's.
There you go.
But I think prayer is that invitation to ask for what you need means don't surrender your agency. Don't surrender the I. You can always ask. Don't, and that is really a plea not to be out of relationship with me. Don't close this connection down. Ask for what you need. I will listen. Yes.
Question.
Yeah.
So, what I'm thinking about chapters 3 to 37 in Job, where perhaps, pushing back on you a little bit, Job gets at least close to asking why me. You could say that he was whining.
You could say that he is whining or not whining.
He is whining.
Yeah.
Perhaps. And certainly protesting. I take the whining and the lack of agency to be victim. I think I'm hearing you say when you hang on to the I, you're not accepting complete victimhood yet.
Yeah.
But in those chapters 3 to 37, he comes pretty darn close to being victim. Would you agree?
I still think it's interesting to see how often he says I. And he's trying a little bit to defend himself. You know, I was righteous. But in a way, he's talking to the wrong person. Because Job's suffering comes not from God, but from the Satan. And it's very interesting. This would be a whole other lecture. But it struck me that Job is really an assertion of the fact that God does not, we're not puppets. That God created, and as Simone Weil, the French philosopher, and wanted a Christian, had she wanted to be a Christian, would say, God created and then withdrew from the world and let free will and necessity to govern in God's place. So there is a kenosis, if you will, or a pouring out of God from the creation that God has made. And God lets free will rule and necessity rule. And I think the Satan is a symbol for that blind necessity that comes. It's not fair. It's not just. It's not the way it was intended, but it is. So, you know, Job is trying to defend himself, but A, he's talking to the wrong person, and B, God is not a puppet master. And that's good news and bad news. We want God to be a puppet master when things are going bad. When things are going okay, we want to take credit. So I find this a really interesting puzzle. A mystery. Carl was thinking about mystery yesterday. Mystery. So I don't know. I wrestle with this text, but my read is that in the end, Job refuses to become a me. Why did you do this to me? But he is talking to the wrong person. it's the Satan who has. Do I think, yeah, all right. Anybody else want to push back or push out or any questions?
Right.
Yeah.
Going back to something that you talked about quite earlier, which relates to naming.
Yeah.
Naming is animation, giving animation to something. There's
louder
a,
for anything.
There is a little bit of a paradox in thinking of naming as that which gives life. Because when we, for example, your friend, when she named the stroke as that which took away all of those
right.
things, she also gave away her power to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about her recovery as involving something where she took back her agency. And when one receives a name,
mm-hmm.
one is in some way partaking of a duality in which one becomes an object of a name. And I'm not even sure what my question is, except that I think there is a paradoxical dark side
to naming. Yeah.
Right. Because there one not only does it give something, it also binds it. An identity which can be limiting.
Yeah. No, I utterly agree. Naming is bivalent. It's ambiguous. It can go in many different directions. I think this is why a lot of people. Oh, my tribe, when they became professional women, they dropped the Y, like they were no longer Marty or Judy. Or Fran, they became Francis and Judith and Martha. You know, it's really interesting. But it's a way of saying, I'm a grown up now. You know, I don't want to the diminutive anymore. Or why a lot of women or men take a new name when they partner. They take a naming always means this and not that. And that's very interesting. But child of God. And child of God means that we're not other things. We're not certain other things. We're not children of the empire. We're not children of families, we're not, you know, it means we're not certain things. So name is always a limit.
But I mean, that's the one name actually which transcends limits. If one thinks of God as the fount of creation, of unlimited
yeah.
potential, if one takes the name as the child of God, one is saying, my name is that
yeah.
which is not limited by name.
Well, you know, and I could come back at you and say, yes, and that infantilizes, you know, because what if we are co-creators? What if we are? What I like about Job is kind of standing up to God in a way. Victim, yes, but he's sort of saying, you owe me an explanation. And what I think happens is God responds in kind. You know, because that connection is open, and is open more or less as peer. You know, I want an explanation. I want you to tell me something. And when God finally speaks, look at how God speaks, and look at what God says. And I just want to say a few things about that, because I think this is where the juice in the book of Job comes, in those divine speeches at the end. Look at how God speaks, and where am I? I think I'm in 39, 38. So if you want to turn to that, I'll read what you need to know. But look at how God speaks. God speaks by questions. By asking questions. And it's really very, very interesting. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? 38:2. Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it, on what were its bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut up the sea with doors when it burst out of the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed the bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thou shalt, this far shall you come and no farther. And here shall your proud waves be stopped. And God goes on and on and on in these questions, which tell a kind of very different story of creation. So how God speaks is very interesting. And what God lays out is a story of creation in a way that is very different from the story in Genesis. But look at who God is talking to. God is talking to a guy who is now out on the fringes of civilization. He used to be at the center of creation, and now Job can't even be in the city. He's abandoned by his friends. He's got no kids. He's got no cattle. He's got no camels. He's kind of worthless. And what God is kind of indicating to him is there's a lot of company out here. In a way, you are not alone. And if you look, I want to look quickly at just a couple of things that illustrate this. Because this is a fairy tale, but here's the wonderment. It seems there's a lot of company out there. When you look at the list of things that this creation machine, and it is kind of a question creation machine, where were you when I created? Listen to the creatures that come out of this creation machine. There are wild animals. There's the wild ass in 39:5. Let me just read you about the wild ass. Who has let the wild ass go free? Free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass, to which I have given the steppe for its home and the salt land for its dwelling place? Okay, so this is a creature that can climb mountains, that is, up into the dome of the sky, and that can go into the salt lands, that is the terrain of the water. This is a wild creature because it sort of crosses boundaries. It's really interesting. It ranges the mountains as a pasture, and it searches for every living thing. Listen to the ostrich. God's created the ostrich, and this is down in 39, I think, 13. The ostrich's wings flap wildly, though its pinions lack plumage, for it leaves its eggs in the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that a wild animal may roam, may trample them. It deals cruelly with its young, as if they were not its own, though its labor should be in vain, yet it has no fear, because God has made it forget wisdom and given it no share in human understanding. When it spreads its plumes aloft, it laughs at the horse and the rider. Well, this is a creature that is of no use, really, even to its young. It doesn't even know how to take care of its kids. And it can't fly. And yet, when the ostrich flaps its beautiful plumes, it scares horses, and the horse dismantles the rider. So this is the creature that is utterly useless to the human project, and in fact, even kind of disruptive of the human project. It serves no purpose but beauty. This is another creature that is in air and in land. It crosses boundaries. It's not around. It seems useless to the human project. There are two more creatures that I want to look at because I think they typify who these things are in this alternative creation story. And these last two creatures, the voice from the whirlwind, these last two creatures are the behemoth and the leviathan. And the behemoth, probably a rhinoceros or a hippo character. And the description of that is in, the description of the behemoth is in 40 verse 15. Yeah. Look at the behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Its strength is in its loins and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are knit together. Its bones are the tubes of bronze. Its limbs are like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. For the mountains yield food for it where all the wild animals play. Under the lotus it lies, in the covert of the reeds and in the marsh. The lotus trees cover it for shade, and the willows of the wadi around it. Even if the river is turbulent, it cannot be frightened. It is confident, though Jordan rushes against its mouth. Can one take it with hooks or pierce it with a snare? So, this is a fabulous creature. It's a creature of land and water. It doesn't stay where it belongs, according to the first account of Genesis. But God really delights in it. And it's utterly useless to the human project. The Leviathan is kind of the behemoth of the ocean. And it's described, there is terror all around its teeth, and its sneezes flash forth light, and its eyes are the eyelids of the dawn. The Leviathan is kind of the most monstrous of the sea creatures, but wouldn't you love to see those eyes? So all of these creatures are kind of on the edges of civilization. These creatures are all, they're not part of the human project, and Job himself is no longer part of the human project. He's not useful to anybody. He's outside the walls of the city. Can't give advice anymore, nobody will come see him. And God, in these speeches, is saying, I love what I have made. I love all of it. I delight in all of it. I delight even in you. So Job, in his uselessness and in his isolation and in his suffering, is not abandoned. Job has just joined the wild things. And it's turned Job, in a way, into this wild and crazy bunch of creatures. And Job is assured that whatever happens, God still loves him and God still delights in him. And in the end, okay, Job gets back all of his stuff from before. He gets back camels, he has new children, he gets back all of his land, and everything happens. And Job has three daughters. This is in the last chapter of Job. This is just parenthetic. I don't know quite what to make of this. But we know that his daughters are more beautiful than anything else in the land. Again, they have no purpose but beauty. And Job calls them, the names Job gives them are not like faith, hope, and charity, or prudence, or the names that Job gives them are Jemima, which is a kind of beauty that, beauty like the dawn, and Cassia, which is the name for a perfume, and Karen Hupik, which is kind of a black, cold eyeliner. Yeah, I love it. So Job has kind of gotten the message that the wild things, it's okay to be wild. And he's brought the experience of being a wild thing back into his own. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say about Job. I think I understand why it's not taught in Sunday school. I mean, who would pick up their toys? But it is really an alternative story of creation, because we've got, you know, a creation that includes boundary crossers and things that don't stay in their places, things that don't do what they're supposed to do, things that cross over. And I'm sure that we've been in places like that ourselves, and it's nice to know that we've got some company there. So I wanted to end with that. We're almost out of time. Any questions or comments? We can come back to some of these tomorrow. Yeah.
Ending it this way, there's a pretty good chance this wasn't, this happy ending is tacked on, according to some folks.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have here in Job is like a bar bet. You know, God and Hasatan have this bar bet. Say, everything's cool, look at Job. And Satan said, well, you wouldn't be that way if you didn't have everything. So they do this thing. There's all these people that get killed.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these animals that get killed. And especially when Job ends this way,
mm-hmm.
I dislike this happy ending, because it says all those people are gone. It's not that those people got restored to life or anything, the sons
yes.
and the daughters
yeah.
that got killed when the tents collapsed and the
right.
fires happened. So that's what's frustrating. Not only don't get the toys get put away, but you potentially got a God that would do something like this, even once. That comes
yeah.
in it comes into our realm and says, I'm just gonna see what happens if I do this.
Let me, you know, the story, I really want to underscore, and I'm not sure I understand this.
No.
But the devastation is caused by the Satan.
Mm-hmm.
The Satan is the agent of destruction. The trouble is that God doesn't intervene to stop the Satan.
Doesn't he approve it the second time?
The Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord gives the lives of everybody, but Job's life himself.
Yes.
To Satan.
Yeah. And that's the troubling piece. God doesn't cause this devastation or author it, but God lets it happen. And that's the question.
But how do you say he doesn't author it? That he, does
mm-hmm. he authorizes it.
He authorized, yeah, that's a good distinction. Yeah.
And then the naming thing, is it genocide or is it just Syria? Or was it genocide or was it Rwanda? And that's another
yeah.
naming thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
so people who have the means to do something are comfortable not doing something by the name something is given. And it's just interesting. I don't mean to like, I'm very interested in this story of creation, and it's something I had never thought of in this book, which I love.
Yeah.
But it's that start is something.
Yeah, it's a rugged start. God doesn't cause the genocide,
mm-hmm.
but God, in a way, stands back. I prefer the and maybe I'm dancing around this, but I think God steps back.
Mm-hmm.
It's that approach where God pours God's self out of the creation that God has made and leaves the creation to run on necessity. And I see the Satan's act, I see genocide, I see those things to be necessity and free will. and we know how twisted free will can be, as mm-hmm. in the case of genocide.
True.
And I don't think that God for a moment isn't weeping about that. I'm not sure that's in this story. But there is, what we get is a scope of creation that is very different from a place for everything and anything, everything in its place.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to wrestle with the fact that there are things over which God has withdrawn control from, mm-hmm. that are left to run on their own. Yeah.
It's an archetype, really.
Yes.
Of the crucifixion. It's an archetype of the fact that God allowed Calvary to happen.
That's another place in which God...
But in the end, resurrection, new life, new creation, I guess you could call it really a prefiguring in a different kind of story
mm-hmm.
of what happens in the New Testament.
And I think there's a... Because we get resurrection on the heels of crucifixion in the New Testament, we don't linger long enough in the Passion, in Holy Friday and Holy Saturday, Good Friday and Holy Saturday, which is a time when we don't know the end of the story, and we are shaking our fist at God saying, why are you letting this happen? Why did this happen? And I think we get to do that. I think we have to do that to understand the power of resurrection. Yeah.
I like the idea that Job is an archetype of Calvary. Terry Frenheim at Luther Seminary says that when God said, behold, it's all good in the creation, that doesn't mean that it's all perfect.
Yeah.
And Frenheim makes the assertion, and Job kind of underscores it, that creation contains dangers.
Mm-hmm.
There are floods, and there are hurricanes, mm-hmm. and there are earthquakes, and tragic diseases, and deaths, and... And it didn't just come about since the fall, that even in the creation itself, there are these dangers.
Yeah. There are these dangers, and a lot of the creatures in the divine speeches, they are useless to the human project, and in sometimes even destructive of the human project. And I think the important thing that God is communicating to Job is creation is a lot more than you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's important
yeah.
to get to the humility. But you're right, we never get the old creation back again. Job never gets his old kids back. He gets new kids. And he names them. I want to hold to time because I know there's yoga and you have other things to do, but thanks for taking this deeper. And tomorrow we'll look at Matthew and the creation story in Matthew, which is the creation of the disciples. But we'll come back to this. If there are any questions, just like I did in the beginning, bring me the beginning.